Hello and welcome to another edition of On Mic with Jordan Rich, conversation alive and well with people who have a lot to say and a lot to offer. Today I welcome a prominent historian and commentator on Middle Eastern affairs, Daniel Pipes. He's taught history at Harvard and the University of Chicago, has served on the State Department's policy planning staff under President Reagan, and has authored 19 books, including the one we're focusing on today called Israel Victory, How Zionists Win Acceptance and Palestinians Get Liberated. Daniel Pipes will offer up his thoughts on how to solve the unsolvable, the Israeli-Palestinian conflicts. Let's get into it now with our guest, Professor Daniel Pipes. Let's go on, Mike. The one thing that I didn't really know enough about, and I feel I learned a lot, Israel wasn't a country yet in the 1880s or so. Can you just brief us as to what was going on back then?
Well, the Zionist movement began in the 1880s, and it was literally a handful of young men from Eastern Europe who were not farmers, who didn't speak Arabic, who were just filled with zeal and ideals. And they found themselves surrounded by a far, far greater population that was basically hostile. And I'm arguing that in that extremely early circumstance, two mentalities got set in stone on the Palestinian, what the people we now call Palestinians. On the Palestinian side, it was, we hate you, get out of here, we want to kill you, no, no, no. And on the eventually to be called Israeli side, wait a minute, give us a chance, we'll benefit you. We come from the modern West, we can enhance your lives, clean water, deep water ports, and so forth. And so the former I call rejectionism, no, no, no. The latter I call conciliation. Please give us a chance. We'll make things better. And it's 140 years later. Circumstances have completely changed. It's the Israelis with the wings of F-35s and high rises. It's the Palestinians who are poor and oppressed. And yet, despite all those differences, the mentalities remain in place. And I argue that if there's going to be change, it has to be the Israelis that break with this traditional mentality and understand their mistake and then coerce the Palestinians to break with their mentality of rejectionism. So it starts with the Israelis. So the book is essentially directed towards Israelis.
October 7th of last year, did that indicate a sea change in the Israeli thinking? Obviously, things are happening on the ground as we speak. And as we record this, we're just a few days, if not a week or two away from the anniversary. But did that alter the spectrum of Israeli thought, do you think?
Initially, it appeared that way. In the rest of October of 2023, it appeared like there had been a sea change. By the time November rolled around, no. Things had pretty much reverted. And you can see it in the strength of what I call the hostage lobby, as opposed to the victory lobby. Tens, hundreds of thousands of people on the street and find international support. In other words, the lobby argues that the most important thing for Israel to do is to get the hostages back, as opposed to the most important thing that Israel can do is destroy Hamas. I would say that the hostage lobby is still in a pre-October 7th mindset.
Now, the reactionist movement on the other side seems to have been stoked for decades by those teaching in schools, the little kids in Saudi Arabia, let's say, that there's a blood libel and Jews are responsible and must be wiped off the planet and taken away from Israel and thrown into the sea. I mean, all that kind of stuff, all that kind of hatred and vitriol seems to just keep coming.
There is some good news. There is some good news. The Arab states, when they got their independence, mostly in the 40s and 50s, saw anti-Zionism as a vehicle to motivate and distract their subject populations. Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian leader, was the paramount figure. And it worked. They got their populations very excited, very anti-Israel. But by 1973, the Arab states had paid a high price for their fighting Israel. And they basically pulled out. I argue that the Arab states were directly involved against Israel for 25 years, 1948 to 1973, from the independence of Israel to the 73 war, and have been pretty much absent, with some exceptions, since 1973, over 50 years, over twice as long. And so over time, the Arab states have come to see the fervid anti-Zionism of their populations as an obstacle, as a problem. And so you see that Arab states, in a slow but steady way, are tending to decrease their hostility towards Israel, whether in political speeches or in school textbooks. Saudi Arabia is a good example. It was one of the worst, and now it's pretty benign. So Arab states are pulling out.
The Abraham Accords a few years ago made it pretty obvious that these countries were interested in ending hostility and creating at least a more peaceful coexistence. So it can work.
Yeah, the Arab states were defeated. I talk about Israel victory in the context of the Palestinians, but I believe that Israel has already had victory over the Arab states. Arab states are basically dictatorships. And so a single individual, be it Anwar Sadat or King Hussein or Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, can on his own decide, okay, out. This was a voluntary engagement and we can pull out. And they do.
We think of Iran as the central point of terrorism, fostering terrorism around the world, particularly in the Middle East. How do we combat that mindset to spewing this, not only hate, but sending rockets and missiles and arms to these terrorists? How do we stop that?
Well, Iran is a regime in decline. The government has scarce support, maybe 15-20%, 10-20% of the population actively supports it. If the United States government would finally decide that it wants to see the end of this regime, that would be a great step forward. But since 45 years, since 1979, since the inception of the Islamic Republic of Iran, there's never been the goal of the United States government to get rid of the Islamic Republic. So I think that's the place to start. We can't leave it to Israel. Israel's a small country. It's just reaching 10 million people now. Iran has on the order of 80 million people. We're 330 million people. You know, we can take on Iran, not Israel.
It's now time to talk about what's going on here in the West. The moral equivalency issue between the Hamas and Israel on the part of the protesters and people in our government is just abhorrent to people like myself, and I'm sure you agree. What has happened to particularly the left in this country and in Europe to promote the idea that Hamas and those on that side are doing the right thing?
If you look at the long stretch since Israel's inception in 1948, just over three quarters of a century ago, you see steady progression in two directions. The right has become increasingly friendly, and the left has become increasingly hostile, step by step by step, and it continues. On the part of the left, it's a focus on the Palestinians, on the West Bank and Gaza in particular. The hostility towards Israel has little to do with Iran, Turkey, or the Muslim citizens of Israel itself, or economics within Israel, or politics within Israel. That's really not important. Yeah, there's this extraordinary focus on Gaza and the West Bank and the perceived iniquities, open air prison and the like. Genocide, white supremacism, and the like. And this is the great success of the Palestinian movement. It has been unsuccessful in any practical sense, poor economy, oppression, and the like. But it has, to a unique extent, found a global support network. Nothing like it. Never been anything like it. Nothing in the world today like it, of Muslims, and it is growing and growing, I like to point to Argentina and Chile, next to each other at the very south of South America, and very, very far from Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. And yet what you see there are two very clashing leaderships. On the one hand, rich, young, far-left Chilean president despises Israel. And on the other hand, Javier Milei, the new Argentinian president, who embraces Israel, literally. It's the left and the right for you, and you see it around the world.
Anti-Jew, anti-Semitism, how much of that is tied into the anti-Israel movement, do you think?
It's certainly inherent to it. Anti-Zionism is not necessarily anti-Semitic. One can not like Israel for other reasons, for example, leftist Jews who don't like Israel. But yeah, it's a major component. And this points to the fact that anti-Semitism, which historically is a phenomenon of the right, has since 1945 increasingly become a phenomenon of the left and of Muslims. It used to be the right and Christians, now it's the left and Muslims. And indeed, it's the left and Muslims who are the most hostile to Israel.
There's a lot of study about war in the book and how to see war to its ultimate conclusion so that there's some success at the end of it. And I'm reminded of that great movie with George C. Scott playing General Patton and that opening monologue when he says, "Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser." That's not the case in today's world. The American government, particularly the ones in power now, are very much into stalemate, into, as you say, conciliation.
It's a truism that human nature remains the same, even while technology changes. So you go from battle axes to tanks, it's still the same war. But in fact, there was a change in 1945. Something happened in 1945, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they developed a theory among American academics at first, and then military planners, politicians, that you can't win a war. You don't want to win a war. It's futile. And so the permanent emphasis from the ancients to World War II, that the victory, the goal of war is victory over your enemy, disappeared. And it disappeared first among Americans and among Westerners, including Israelis. It did not have a resonance in non-Western parts of the world, be they Palestinians or Russians or Chinese. They still want victory. But in the West, the dropping of atomic weapons had this profound change. And I think we're only slightly coming out of it now. So, for example, if you look at the American response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the most unlikely people have been talking about victory. Let's say Ukrainian victory over Russia. So I see something of a break with that now, almost 80-year-old pattern, but it's still not broken.
Daniel, the fact that we were able to achieve denazification after World War II and turn Japan from a mortal enemy with soldiers willing to die for their emperor into a very close ally, even Vietnam, take a look at that situation. Is it comparable to what's going on with the Muslim fanatics? Are they capable, if we figure out a way to eliminate the head of the snake, are they capable, the people themselves, of being, shall we say, civil to others, living in this world together in peace? Is it possible to take the ideas and dissolve them?
I do think so, though I'd hasten to point out that Vietnam and China and Japan are very different. We lost in Vietnam, we won in Japan. But yes, my favorite example is Anglo-French hostility. It's awfully remote right now, but those two countries across the English Channel were at war for 750 years, including, for example, the Hundred Year War. Very brutal. It was only in 1904, 750 years. Finally, one day, they made up. And they made up in this case because they had a common enemy in Germany. And for over a century now, it seems slightly ridiculous that these two countries would have been at war, but they were for a very, very long time. So yes, none of this is written in stone. People change. And while the 1904 example points to another way of ending a war, the usual one is victory and defeat, or more precisely, defeat. You fail to achieve your military goals, you give up and you move on. And that's where Vietnam would come in. We failed, we moved on. And now we get along with the Vietnamese and they get along with us.
Because Israel is such a small country in terms of area and population, and because they are surrounded by enemies, it makes it that much more challenging for them to wake up every day and think that they're going to be able to make peace with these people who have sworn to kill them and wipe them off the face of the earth. And yet, who was it, Einstein, who said insanity is doing the same thing wrong over and over again? We've seen countless attempts to bring conciliation, bring even ceasefires up, mainly to benefit the Palestinian people, not necessarily to help the Israelis. Now, why should it now be different? And how can the Israelis affect that change?
I believe that the Israelis themselves have to be convinced that they need to win, something which is, I'm happy to say, increasingly popular idea. when I came up with this notion 25 years ago, it was simply obscure. Now, for example, Prime Minister Netanyahu has spoken literally dozens and dozens of times about victory, total victory, complete victory since October 7th. It is no longer a strange idea, but there's a long way to go still. It's one thing to talk about it, it's another to affect it. That's the purpose of my writing this book.
The Palestinian Authority and the quote-unquote government body that was Hamas, just absolutely devastating to their populations and a threat to Israel. And yet we collectively in the West gave them billions of dollars and they squandered it not on helping their people, but on building weapons to try to destroy and wipe out Israel.
I tend not to blame the West so much as I do Israelis. It's the Israelis who encouraged, for example, Qatar to spend millions and millions in Gaza to go to Hamas. I don't think one can expect Americans or Belgians or Finns or Japanese to understand the situation as well as Israelis do. And the Israelis got it wrong. The Israelis thought, if there's money going to Hamas and Gaza more broadly, then you'll find late model cars and fine apartments and good schools, and the population will become bourgeois and no longer want to make war. Well, this was obviously silly understanding, but it was the Israeli understanding. And so I blame the Israelis, or more exactly, I blame the Israeli security establishment, which came up with these conciliatory ideas. Give them money and they will be less of an enemy. Whereas in fact, give them money and they build up their arsenal was what happened, but the Israelis didn't want to see it.
Let's take a look finally at the military approach. As we all know, the Israelis pulled off one of the most amazing targeted attacks on the beeper explosions and put a lot of terrorists on the disabled list and killed some. A brilliant strategic move. But what does it take militarily to consider victory in this case? I mean, obviously wiping out the infrastructure of Hezbollah and Hamas, but what do you see as victory militarily?
I might just point out it was a brilliant tactical move, not a strategic move. Well, I think there's a huge difference between the Israeli war on Hamas and the Israeli war on Hezbollah. Hamas is Palestinian, is exclusively dedicated to destroying the Jewish state. And therefore, Israel must destroy Hamas. And that is indeed the proclaimed goal. In the case of Hezbollah, no one in Israel that I've heard of, or in any way authority, has talked about destroying Hezbollah. They're talking about deterring Hezbollah. They're not trying to eliminate it. They'd love to eliminate it, but that's not their goal. They're trying to stop it from sending over the missiles and rockets to Israel, as Hezbollah has been doing since October 8th, I think. So it's a much lesser goal. And whereas ceasefire, in the case of Hamas, is essentially a capitulation to Hamas, ceasefire in the case of Hezbollah is, in contrast, a capitulation by Hezbollah. It'd be Hezbollah saying, okay, we're going to stop sending over rockets and missiles. And that's what Israel wants. So the Israeli goal vis-a-vis Hezbollah is far less ambitious. Just get it to stop fighting, not try and destroy it.
Final point on my end. I've been to Israel twice. I was there in August of last year before the October 7th massacre. I'm totally amazed, as most people are when they go for the first or second time, that these Israelis, both Arab and Jew, survive and thrive amidst all of this danger that's currently around them, that's been around them for all these years. The spirit of the Israeli people is pretty impressive, isn't it?
It's remarkable. It's a remarkable country. And it's good that you mentioned the Arabs or the Muslims of Israel. They constitute 20%, not a small number. And they are... On one hand, they are quite content. On the other hand, they're quite discontent. They're content with their insurance schemes and their incomes, and they're discontent politically. So unstable situation. But overall, Israel is remarkable. I like to point to a couple of statistics. One is that in the developed world, that is, say, the rich world, there's only one country that has a birth rate that is significantly over replacement being 2.1 per woman, And that's Israel with something like 3.1 or even 3.2. Extraordinary. And secondly, water. The region is suffering from water limitations and deprivations. And Israel has plenty. In fact, it's exporting water. So it's a great success story. And it's done this in the face of tremendous adversity and hostility.
I believe your book offers a pathway to success. I just hope enough people not only read it, but take it to heart. People who matter. It's called Israel Victory, How Zionists Win Acceptance and Palestinians Get Liberated. It's very important, that subtitle. You cover so much in the book, and I really found it fascinating. Daniel, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you for your kind words. Appreciate it.
My thanks once again to Daniel Pipes, author of his latest book, Israel Victory, How Zionists Win Acceptance and Palestinians Get Liberated. Whether you agree with his ideas or not, there's certainly no doubt he knows a lot about the subject. Thank you so much for subscribing and downloading the podcast and for your ratings and reviews. We appreciate that. Find out more at chartproductions.com or jordanrich.com. And as always, remember to be well so you can do good. Take care.